This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
And start by thanking you for coming here and being here tonight. This talk is called Skills for Being Human in a Pornified Culture. And to give you an idea of where we're going to go tonight, the first part of the lecture is going to be me giving you lots of information on the nature of porn today and some sociological as well as neurological research on the effects of porn on people. Then we're going to change gears or change tempos a little bit and talk. So that first part is going to be talking more about a pornified culture. And the second part is going to be more dealing with skills for being human. So things we can do for ourselves, especially if we've struggled with pornography for a while. And this is actually the third time I've given a talk on pornography. So if you've been here before, some of this will be familiar or you might have heard before, but some of it is new. But as a way into the talk tonight, I want to share a story that a friend shared with me. He gave me, we had some long conversations about the issue of pornography and pornography addiction. And he wanted to talk about it because he knew I'd given some talks here and he wanted to get my thoughts on things. But he told me a story which gave me an image that gave me a different way of thinking about what is going on in people's lives who look at pornography habitually or addictively or compulsively. And the image is hiding under the stairs. And so at this point, when I knew this person, he was in his mid-20s. He'd been looking at pornography for a solid 15 years. He stumbled across it around the time he was 10. And looked at it pretty regularly since then on. Maybe a month here and a month there of abstinence, but it had been something that had dominated his life. But probably the fifth or sixth conversation we were having, he told me a story about when he was little. And he said when he was little, his parents would fight, and it would just frighten him. It would rock his world, and he didn't know what to do, so he would run to this cupboard that was under the stairs in his house, and he would lock himself in the cupboard. And when he was in the cupboard, his parents' fighting was somewhere else. He couldn't hear it. He was safe. He protected himself under the cupboard. Under the stairs was a place to find escape from something that was understandably difficult for a small child to deal with. And he said that for him, in many ways, looking at porn had become a similar thing. Looking at porn really wasn't just about his uncontrollable male libido or raging pubescent lust, areas of his life that he had tried for years and years to gain traction in or over but hadn't. And though they were a part of what was going on, they lacked the explanatory power to adequately describe how porn had become such a large part of his life and for such a long period of time. And what was more difficult with this for him was he hated porn. He wanted nothing to do with porn. He knew it was wrong, it was immoral, it was unhealthy, but he couldn't pull himself away from looking at it. So his ideals of sexual behavior, or the ideals of the type of person he wanted to be, weren't lining up with his behavior. And he was just confused, and he wasn't sure. And he saw that this same pattern was anytime a difficult situation would arise in his life, something that was hard for him to deal with, something that was discomforting, something that was painful, porn was there, and it was an easy way to not deal with the difficult things in his life. And so it created a pattern of avoidance that kept going. So whether it was the stress of finding a job, dealing with difficult coworkers, taking steps towards choosing a career path, the reality that he felt really lonely in real life because he lived so much of his life online, he felt pain from other people's disapproval, all of these things he didn't know what to do with, and they were uncomfortable for him, and it would send him back to porn. But as you might guess, this strategy of avoidance actually just created more pain for him. It created significantly more problems for him. And it stunted his growth in ways, stunted his growth as a human, as a person, in ways that he didn't expect. And my friend is hardly unique in this matter, and so I want to jump in by talking a little bit about the size of the porn industry today. So this is an infographic that was given from a porn site called Pornhub, which is the 37th most visited website in the world. To give you an idea, eBay is the 43rd. So it is a very popular website. And this is their infographic year in review for 2015. And there's lots of things on there that I don't understand, like a petabyte. I don't know what that is. And they've updated it. They're, the 2017 one actually just came out. All of these numbers are up. But what I think is, getting used to this thing. What I think is just striking about this particular infographic is this guy right here, this picture. And it is a picture of a humanoid. And so according to sort of prevailing theories of human evolution, we are part of the final stage of evolution. We've been around for 200,000 years. We're humanoids. 200,000 years. Our ancestors go back 6 million years, according to this theory. Now, if there's 8,760 hours in a year, which means in our 200,000 years of being humanoids, there have been 1,752,000,000 hours of existence. And so just in 2015, just on Pornhub, they streamed 4,392,486,580 hours of porn. So that means there was more porn streamed in 1 year on this one website than we've lived. Almost twice, almost three times as long, two and a half times as long. It's sort of a stunning, sobering thing to think that much porn was streamed from one website. And from here, I just want to talk about the nature of porn today. This and this Pornhub is... Oh, actually, I have this, which is... sorry, I'm really not used to this clicker thing. I mean, you're going to be seeing that screen a lot. They released this year, which is just an interesting, potentially hopeful, different sort of infographic. So when this is what they tracked during the lunar during the solar eclipse that happened in August. So here's where the solar eclipse went. And it's marking how in every state, almost every single state, porn traffic dropped during the eclipse because people went outside and weren't looking at their screen. It's amazing. And in some of these states, like this state right here, this perfectly square state that I'm pretty sure is Colorado, it was down 54%. all right, I'm done. Yeah, I know, my son would know this. But it shows, it's a fascinating thing to show how they've tracked information. And the fact that something brought people outside and off of their phones and off of their computers. But I want to talk a bit about the nature of porn today, not just the size of the industry. And if statistics are true, most people in this room already know what I'm going to say. But so whether or not you fall inside or outside of societal norms, it's worth taking a moment and being clear of the nature, the content of internet porn today. Because it is not just naked bodies. It's not just naked bodies having sex. And so I'm drawing this from an essay by this woman, Anna Bridges, that references a previous study. It's in this book called The Social Costs of Pornography. And the study is called Aggression and Sexual Behavior in Best-Selling Pornography, a Content Analysis Update. And it says this. The majority of the scenes in the 50 most-watched porn movies contain both physical and verbal abuse of the female performers. Physical aggression, which includes spanking, open-handed slapping, and gagging occur in over 88% of the scenes. While expressions of verbal aggression, calling the woman such names as bitch or slut, were found in 48% of the scenes. And then Bridges and Wasnitzer go on to say that if we combined both physical and verbal aggression, our findings indicate that nearly 90% of the scenes contained at least one aggressive act, with an average of nearly 12 acts of aggression per scene. They also said that by far the victims' most common responses were pleasure or neutrality. And so feminist professor communication studies at Wheelock College, which is just down the road in Boston, a woman named Gail Dines, has written a very difficult but important book called Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. She also runs a website called Culture Reframed. This is sort of their tagline, solving the public health crisis of the digital age. There's a lot of really wonderful, helpful resources. She's not a person of faith whatsoever, but she's happy to be a co-belligerent along with anyone else who's anti-porn. She's probably the leading researcher and leading anti-porn advocate in the world today. And in this book, she makes a compelling research-based case that the majority of internet porn has surprisingly little to do with sex. It actually has much more to do with domination and degradation. And if you think that that sounds like something you would expect from a feminist professor of communication studies, consider this quote from a veteran porn actor, director, and producer, a guy named Bill Margold, who's recently passed away. And he speaks of his work like this, and this is sort of the last rough thing for the evening. He says this, I'd like to really show what I believe men want to see, violence against women. I firmly believe that we serve a purpose by showing that. The most violent we can get is the cum shot in the face. Men get off behind that because they get even with the women they can't have. We try to inundate the world with orgasms in the face. End of quote. And then another director who was with him during this interview said, it's like a dog marking its territory. So it's pretty gnarly stuff. But to be clear, I think when the average 11-year-old goes online, and 11 is the average age of exposure for boys today, and they Google porn, they Google boob, they Google sex, they're not looking to find this sort of thing. This is not what they're intending to find, but it's what they will find. And in fact, Dine's book, Pornland, starts by typing in those words in a Google search, and she just describes what you can see without a credit card, without a filter, in just 15 clicks. And to be exposed to this sort of porn at a young age, or really any age, brings up complex emotional and psychological responses. Watching this sort of stuff can be simultaneously arousing, disturbing, shameful, confusing. It creates something of a toxic stew, I think, in people's stomach. But it starts to hook them. But not only does it start to hook them, it teaches them. This is another essay by in that same collection of essays. This one is by Marianne Layden, who's a psychotherapist who teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. And her essay is called Pornography and Violence, A New Look at the Research. And she says this, that pornography is the ideal context for learning. She writes that we use better using images than words, because images carry more information in a compact form. Words can be perceived as opinions, but images are perceived as events or facts. You can't really argue with an image. She also says we learn better if we're aroused. If something activates our sympathetic nervous system, we're prepared to remember that information more deeply. She also says learning is better if it's reinforced. Behavior that's rewarded is most likely going to be repeated. So arousal and orgasm are pretty rewarding experiences. She goes on to say, we learn also better if we see others who are modeling behavior rewarded. It has the same effect on us as if we were rewarded ourselves. She closes this article by saying, excuse me, pornography can be extremely effective in producing deeply learned beliefs and behaviors. Pornography can offer all of these elements, images, arousal, reinforcement, the example of others. So it is a potent teacher of both beliefs and behaviors. It provides the ideal conditions for learning. What people are learning as they're consuming this is a false script of the nature of human sexuality. And Leiden's research is from 2010, but this last week, the New York Times Magazine had a cover story. This was the cover. I'll just go past it. It's a little much for me. I don't like looking at it. That was called When Porn is Sex Ed. And it picks up on the same reality that Leiden was talking about 8 years ago. This article presents sociological research that validates her points that whether or not we're aware of it, we're learning from porn, we learn a false sexual script. They actually quote a study from 2016 that said 72% of 16 or 17-year-olds that were surveyed reported porn as their primary source of information about sex, more than friends, siblings, school, or parents. Church isn't even on that list. People, you know, it's not even one of the options that people think about. And what's striking about this article is the comments. There's all these comments from anonymous high schoolers who attend a class in South Boston, actually, that's a porn literacy class, a class that is designed to help people be able to discern what is going on in porn, what's fictitious and what's real, to make them more critical appraisers of the porn they're watching. One of the boys is quoted as saying, "There's nowhere else to learn about sex, and porn stars know what they're doing." It's a really interesting article. You can read it online. Maybe it's a disturbing article as well. But the article falls short, I think, in one very, very significant way, because it doesn't bring into the picture any of the findings. It does so with social sciences, but it doesn't do so. In fact, it dismisses any sort of recent neurological studies on what porn does to your brain. And so young people aren't just learning a false, violent sexual script. They're actually changing the structure of their brain. And so there is a large and growing body of peer-reviewed neurological research into the way porn alters our brains, the way it alters the normal distribution of pleasure chemicals. So it is pretty intense stuff, pretty technical stuff. A lot of it goes over my head, but I'm just going to try to summarize it. But if you're interested, these are two great resources on it. This is the first one on the left is a book, Your Brain on Porn, that summarizes a lot of these studies. It also has a lot of anecdotal stories from people online. I have the book. And then the other is a website called Fight the New Drug that does a great job of distilling a lot of this research into kind of really smoothly designed infographics and like videos. They're very slick. They're very savvy. But to summarize what's been uncovered through this recent research is that our brains are wonderful. Our brains are amazing. And one of the ways that they're wonderful is they reward us for doing good things. They release these certain pleasure chemicals in our brain. We hear about them in other studies. So dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. And this is neurologically speaking why we feel good when we do certain things that are good for us, like exercising or being with friends or being with our children. In fact, one of these chemicals, oxytocin, is a bonding chemical. And it's the chemical that goes off in a mother's brain when she's nursing a child. So the mother is sleep deprived. The mother is exhausted and stressed out. But the brain, and the reason she's stressed out is this adorable little thing that needs her to stay alive and is waking her up and is disrupting her life. But this amazing chemical is released in a mother's brain, oxytocin, that bonds the mother with the child regardless of how little sleep she's had or how exhausted she feels. These are really interesting things that are happening. But the problem is our brains by themselves, while they're wonderful, they're undiscerning. These same pleasure chemicals, which our brain releases during positive activities, are actually released in greater amounts when we do things that aren't so good for us, like hard drugs, or as more recent research has shown, look at porn. These chemicals flood the brain with pleasurable stimulus, which means that you feel really good. In fact, you feel really great, but just for a little while. And this flooding of chemical leaves the brain wanting more of what it had. And as actually they flood the brain, the pathways with which these chemicals go over time and with repeated use deepen. So if I look at porn habitually, if I look at porn a lot, whether it's to sort of medicate pain, whether it's to deal with boredom, whether it's because I just feel aroused, whatever reason is going on, and in a manner that is remarkably similar to what happens to when someone uses hard drugs, my brain begins to readjust to those higher amounts of chemicals that are being released. And over time, I build up a tolerance. So that once, what was once really pleasurable for me, which gave me a rush and it was exciting to me, over time becomes drab and kind of dull. And kind of propels me to find something, a new substance that's maybe a stronger dose. So something that's maybe more extreme. And so I click and I click and I click until I find it. And this is part of the reason why people are being more and more drawn to these extreme, violent forms of pornography. So one prominent neurologist, a guy named Norman Doidge, in a book that's just not about pornography, but just about the brain in general, he does have a chapter in this on pornography. He found that neurologically speaking, when men are surfing porn online, they look a lot like these rats that were used in the research of psychologist B.F. Skinner. These rats would push a lever which would release cocaine, which would give a rush in the rat's brain, and then they would come back and get more. And Doidge says, like addicted rats, the men were desperately seeking the next fix, clicking the mouse just as the rats pushed the lever. Another person doing research in this area is a guy named William Struthers in a very interesting book. He's a professor of psychology at Wheaton College. He's a Christian. And in his important book, Wired for Intimacy, How Pornography Hijacks the Male Brain, he writes this. Sexually acting out in response to pornography creates sexual associations that are stored as hormonal and neurological habits. These associations are seared into the fabric of the brain. In sexual fantasy, the neurological circuit is replayed, further strengthening it. The result is an increase in autonomic sexual arousal, which requires an outlet. He's on to say that each time that an unhealthy sexual pattern is repeated, a neurological, emotional, and spiritual erosion carves out a channel that will eventually develop into a canyon. And so this plays out in pretty dramatic ways of people's lives. Their brains become rewired. They become addicted to porn. There is a growing phenomenon called PIED, or PIED, which stands for porn-induced erectile dysfunction. There was a Time magazine cover story about this in March of 2016. And it's a growing number of people who report an inability to, they've so habituated themselves to just being sexual with a computer screen, they're unable to be sexual with an actual person. There's all sorts of support groups for this online. In fact, a lot of the stuff from this book, Your Brain on Porn, if it comes up, this one, talks a lot about people that are people who are not of faith just want to have sex again, going through periods of abstinence and withdrawal from looking at porn so that they can kind of regain their actual sex life. And so all of this research, I think, gives us a way to think differently, a different way into the conversation about pornography in our culture today. So in a similar way that if you wouldn't tell someone to stop smoking because it's wrong, you wouldn't say it's wrong. You'd say, this will kill you. If you keep smoking, you're going to die. And in a similar way with this research, the neurological research, the sociological research, and I didn't even touch on other areas where there's problems that are being caused, like pornography is more and more commonly a reason why divorce is going on. There's connections with human trafficking. There's connections between pornography and sexual violence. There's the lives of porn stars themselves. The average woman in the industry works for 18 months because it is such a brutal life that they're out. And so instead of just saying to someone, you shouldn't look at porn because it's wrong or it's, you know, it's not good, you can say porn will destroy your life. Porn will mess you up. And it's worth repeating, porn does something to people. You spend time with this thing, you don't come out the same person. And that's what I'm going for in the title of my lecture, and part of the title of my lecture, Pornified. And it's a term that comes from this book, Pornified, by journalist Pamela Paul. The subtitle is How Pornography is Damaging Our Lives, Our Relationships, and Our Family. And she uses this term to say, pornified, she's talking about the way that the aesthetics and the values and the standards of porn have seeped into our cultural life. It's not just that there's more porn than there ever has been before, which hopefully you got that impression from the infograph, or that there's what they call the three A's of internet porn, that it's accessible, you can get it anywhere, you can get a phone signal, it's affordable, that website Pornhub, it's all free. Everything is free on that website and multiple other websites. And it's anonymous. You don't have to go to a store and do the embarrassing thing of buying something or renting something. So those three things. It's not just that there's more porn, but that porn does something to us. It changes us. And that's what I like about this term, pornified. I think it conveys that well. So with all this in play, I am more and more convinced that Christian engagement with these matters can't begin or end with sort of simply saying, this is a sin, and you should stop. That's just not adequate. We should hate porn for the way that it vandalizes our society, it destroys marriages, it wrecks people's brains. But we should also feel sympathy for those people. Porn addicts are not just sort of sexual monsters with this crazy, unsatisfied libido. They're people that are hiding under the stairs often. They're people who don't know how to deal with the difficult things of life. And porn is right there in the palm of their hand. So, to be clear, I do think looking at porn is sinful and that it is a sin and all of that. But I think using the language of sin can be unhelpful because it looks as though it gives the impression that it's an isolated incident. It's just sort of one thing that you do that's been separated from a larger pattern of life. And so one way that I have found helpful to think about this and to talk with some students about this is revisiting an older way of thinking about human behavior, especially human behavior where people feel as though they can't act on their ideals but are compelled or controlled by their cravings. And that's the language of vice and virtue. Vice and virtue. And briefly, these are acquired moral habits which become something like second nature through repetition. So this is different than things you're born with, like being an extrovert or having male pattern baldness. This is behavior which is developed with time and attention and repetition, like knowing how to hit a golf ball with precision. And so these acquired moral habits that become second nature, they help us to live well in the world, which is a virtue, which is an excellence of character, or they hinder us from living well in the world, which is a vice. And if you want to think with me for a minute to sort of understand maybe a little more of what I'm after, think about sledding. Some of you went sledding for the first time in your lives just a few months ago, or just a few weeks ago. It's hard to think there was snow on the ground a few weeks ago. But the first time you go down a hill of blanketed in fresh snow, a path is made. And over time, as more and more sleds run down that same path, the snow gets packed in further. The path smooths out, and there's a groove. There's a little channel. And in fact, that becomes the natural way you go down the hill as you're sledding, unless you steer off of it. It's the natural way because it's been traveled time and time again. And so there's something analogous with our behavior. This is the wisdom of the virtues. The more we practice virtues or the more we give in to vices, the more natural or second nature that behavior comes. So it's not just about doing the right things. It's about becoming a certain type of person. And N.T. Wright, in his really helpful book, After You Believe, talks about this sort of character cultivation as a pattern of thinking and acting which runs right through someone, so that wherever you cut them, as it were, you see the same person through and through. So it's about becoming a certain type of person. So I tend to think of virtues as something like climbing up a mountain. Your ideals, the person you want to be like, is sort of the vista from the top of the mountain. And climbing a mountain is difficult, and it takes work, and it takes time. But as you climb the mountain, you become the type of person that climbing a mountain is easier for. You start to burn off some weight. You start to realize how to not get lost off trails. Your muscles develop, and climbing up a mountain becomes easier. Some people talk about getting in shape as you begin to fall up a mountain. I am not there yet with that, but and vices are like riding a bike down a mountain. At first, it's super easy. You get on your bike, you barely pedal, and you're going fast down the mountain. But it's not long before you realize your pedaling actually isn't what's propelling you at all, that you're being brought down the mountain. And you're at the mercy of the grade of the road, and it's going to take something dramatic for you to get off. And so if you've been flying down the mountain for years and years and years, being dehumanized by porn, having your brain rewired, internalizing false scripts about human sexuality, this talk, or these books, or really any talk by itself, isn't an antidote to unhabituating yourself to porn if you've been doing this for years. It's not the type of problem that's solved with more facts or ideas. What you need to develop are positive habits or virtues, again, which enable you to live well as a human being in the world, to start hiking up the mountain. That's what I was after in the title, with skills for being human. And so this doesn't happen overnight. This doesn't happen in the 45 minutes of a LaBrie lecture. And it doesn't happen by one's sheer willpower alone. But at the same time, it doesn't happen apart from people showing up in their own lives, being involved in their own lives. And this older way of construing human behavior, the vices and the virtues, that we become certain types of people as we do repeated things, it actually overlaps significantly with some of this neurological research that I was talking about before. So this guy, William Struthers from Wheaton, he talks about this. He says, if a corrupted pathway can be avoided, a new pathway can be formed. We can establish a healthy sexual pattern when the neurological flow is redirected towards holiness rather than corrupted intimacy. By intentionally redirecting the neurochemical flow, the path towards right thinking becomes the preferred path and is established as the mental habit. The path to recovery relies on the same rules that govern how the wounds were initially created. By deepening the holiness pathways, we are freed from deciding to do what is right and good as they become part of our embodied nature. I'm going to repeat that last line. By deepening the holiness pathways, which is his way of saying positive pathways, moving towards virtue, we're free from deciding to do what is right and good as they become part of our embodied nature. And so I want to put forward some practices, some virtues that I think can help people who have been trapped in porn for years and years and years, this vicious cycle being brought down the hill. But I want to say before I talk about them that I think these sorts of practices, I've started to think about them as happening within three concentric circles of dependence. And I learned this from a church, an Episcopal church in New York City, where as we try to become a certain type of person, we're always dependent upon God. That's the outer circle. But we're also interdependent within community. That community can be friends, it can be family, it can be siblings, it could be a spouse, it could be a professional therapist. but we're interdependent in those relationships. People depend on us as well. With the goal of becoming independent in self-care, becoming a certain type of person that has the wherewithal and the patience to live life well. And so in the final section, I want to just talk about two virtues in particular that I think are helpful to learn to cultivate. Practice and hope. Or sorry, patience and hope. And the first one, patience, is to help us navigate temptation well, while the second, hope, is to help us not be crushed by our failures. And I should say up front, I don't think there's a silver bullet for, like, breaking free of porn. There's not one way. For every person that has spent years looking at porn, there's different reasons why they're hiding under the stairs or they're looking at porn. And so it takes time. It takes that interdependence within community. Maybe it takes interdependence with a therapist or a priest or a pastor or with friends. But there still are things we can do showing up in our own lives. And I want to start by talking about patience. And I'm talking about a very specific type of patience, being patient with our temptations as a means to resist them. Now, there's all sorts of biblical strategies to deal with temptation. In the Joseph story, or what's called the Joseph strategy sometimes, he runs from temptation. He runs from Potiphar's wife. And in Proverbs, the father tells his son, keep to a path far from the adulterous woman. Don't go near her door. So avoid places of temptation. And then Paul tells the Corinthians to flee from sexual immorality. But these are all strategies of avoidance when temptation comes, to run from them, to avoid them, and to flee from them. But what about those of us who didn't know better, or perhaps didn't heed advice, and after we didn't avoid them, in fact, we dwelled with them and sat with them for a long time. I don't have a screen here. And what are the options? What's the strategy? So I want to present one, and it's being patient with our temptations. So while there's a lot to say about the virtue of patience, for tonight I want to consider two components of patience. I almost said two components of temptation. I'm done for the rest of the night. So the first component is being long-suffering, and the second one is developing imagination. And the first one, being long-suffering, is the willingness and the wherewithal to endure difficulty and the discomfort of temptation. I'll say more in a second. And the second one, imagination, is the task of changing perspective or reframing how we think of temptation when we experience it. So first, patience as long-suffering. Tim Keller, the pastor from New York City, talks about patience as a love for the long haul, bearing up under difficult circumstances without giving up or giving in to bitterness. And John Stott, a great pastor who's passed away, who was in London, calls patience a social virtue, where one is long-suffering towards those who aggravate or persecute. Being long-suffering. So think with me for a moment why people, perhaps you, scratch bug bites. Most of us do this, and we know better. We know we shouldn't do this. We know if we scratch the bug bite, it will relieve the itch, it'll be gone, but that eventually the itch comes back again. It brings a moment of relief, but it actually prolongs the life of the bug bite. The more you scratch, the better you feel in the moment, but the longer the itch sticks around. And I think there's a similar dynamic at play when we immediately or quickly or compulsively act on our cravings or our temptations instead of being patient or long-suffering with them, not collapsing under them because they're discomfort or because they're uncomfortable. So we often tell ourselves things like resisting temptation or a craving is too hard. It's too much work. We don't have the strength to hold up under these things, to withstand them. They're too much to bear, which is directly the opposite of what the Apostle Paul tells the Corinthians in Corinthians 10, but there's no temptation that's unusual to you. There's nothing that you have to give into, but God is faithful. He'll give you a way to escape. So more times than not, I act on my cravings and give in to my temptations because I'm not patient enough with them and long-suffering enough to feel them as uncomfortable and let them run their course. When temptation comes on, we experience them as discomfort, and more times than not, we act on them to relieve the discomfort. Whether we're hungry, whether we're aroused, whether we're stressed, whether we're bored, instead of letting these things run their course, we act so they immediately go away. But the problem with this is instead of weakening the craving or temptation, it might disappear for a while, we've strengthened it, both as a habit and as a neurological habit. So C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity has an interesting thought about temptation that I think is sort of what I'm trying to say here. And he says this: a silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. After all, you only find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in. You find out the strength of the wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in. We never find out the strength of the evil impulse inside us until we try to fight it. And Christ, who is the only man who never yielded to temptation, is the only man who knows to the full extent what temptation means. The only complete realist. So developing a willingness to be long-suffering, to experience the discomfort of temptation, is one way to work through it. But there's a second component, I think, that needs to go along with this. Not just long-suffering, but imagination. And so when you hear me say imagination, you might think of pretending or make-believe or not real, which is not what I mean by imagination. Instead, and here's a slightly cumbersome definition, by imagination, I mean the faculty by which we comprehend, interpret, and organize our reality. It is a means by which we know, and which enables us to make connections between things which might not be readily apparent in the moment. So, maybe an example that would be helpful for this. So imagine two medieval stonemasons hard at work chiseling away at huge blocks of rock. When they're asked what they're doing, the first stonemason quickly and coldly says to you, "I'm cutting this stone into perfect squares, and then I'm moving them over there into that pile." Yet if you ask the second stonemason, he looks you straight in the eye with excitement, and he says, "I'm building a cathedral." Now, they're both right in their answer, but one takes imagination, the ability to not just see the stones, but to perceive the purpose in the work, and which holds the potential to reframe the nature of what's going on in the moment. I'm sure that that second stonemason had spent significantly more time in cathedrals, listening to people's voices bounce off the walls or watching the sunlight stream in, like in this. Anyway, but it's important to realize, too, that our imagination isn't just funded by stats or propositions or principles. It's funded by and made up by stories, true stories, by images, by experiences, by the concrete things of our life. And a well-exercised imagination enables us to reframe difficult moments, including moments of temptation. And so to perceive them not just as this imminent threat that's going to overpower me and take me over, but instead to perceive it as a moment to put into practice our ideals. An opportunity to move towards the integration of our ideals and our behavior, something which takes a lifetime and people don't ever actually fully arrive at, but it takes a lifetime of acting on opportunities. Sometimes therapists refer to this sort of thing as cognitive restructuring, the deliberate choice to change how we view the moment of temptation or difficulty. Again, not just to see it as a threat, but to see it as an opportunity to put our ideals into practice. And so I want to give a few ideas about practical things potentially to do to grow in patience. And the great thing about patience is whether or not you struggle with porn, you most likely need to be more patient. But some of these answers are more specifically for people who are struggling with pornography. So I've been asked before what I think is the best, like, single thing that someone can do to help break patterns of compulsive porn use. And I've said, and I'm still pretty much convinced, I think the best thing you can do is to start volunteering in a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter. Put yourself, your whole person, in a place that's difficult, that's uncomfortable, that's going to require a certain amount of attention and presence to the people that are there. And it teaches you, it doesn't only teach you patience in dealing with what's most likely a difficult or uncomfortable context. It also teaches you courage, because you have to step up and do something that's out of your comfort zone. So doing something that gets you, that challenges you, that requires attention and skill and presence. I think the second thing we can do, another thing we can do, is fill our imaginations with stories of human excellence. Concrete people whose lives show us that, yes, the good life is hard, but it's possible. This is the role of heroes, I think, in our lives. Dick, who also works here, whoever I think you all know, has done some really helpful work on heroes as models of human excellence, people that we can look to and be compelled by. And a great place to start, I think, that's just almost like an inventory of these sort of people, is David Brooks's book, The Road to Character. It's a great book. Another thing we can do, and this is if our imaginations are shaped by and work with the concrete things in life, I think we can consider the power of nudges. Is anyone familiar with nudges and, like, nudge theory? Or there's a book called Nudges. Dick has read it. But nudges are small changes in the environment around us that make it easier for us to make the choice we want to make. So nudges aren't things that make us do anything. They're an attempt to make certain choices easier or more likely. And these things are around us all the time. So if you go to a Chinese food buffet, really any buffet, I suppose. glad I clarified that. But if you go to a buffet, at the start of the buffet, you'll find things that are low cost and high profit to the restaurant. You'll find things like salad and beans. And their hope is you'll see those things first, and it will nudge you towards filling your plate up with them. So by the time you get to the end, where there's chicken wings and there's roast beef and all those things that are high cost to the restaurant and low profit, your plate's already too full. So they've nudged you towards making a certain type of decision that's good for them. Grocery stores do this. Candy and chips are up front by the checkout aisle, while milk and eggs, which are often not sold at a profit, are in the back. So you got to go all the way to the back to get them. But our environments are nudging us towards certain type of behavior all the time. So I've told people to rearrange their room. If there's places that you regularly look at porn at, change the room. Take all the furniture out, paint the walls a different color, rearrange the furniture so that your brain isn't automatically cued, oh, this is the sort of thing that happens in this place. And that happens at a deep subconscious level. It doesn't happen up top. There's actually a really disturbing study that William Struthers in Wired for Intimacy talks about, where they were studying a group of men and what goes on in their brains when they were looking at porn. And so they're all wired up. And then they looked at porn where there was a red baseball cap hanging on the corner of the computer screen. And then they did this time and time again for I don't know how many hours. And then they had them look at the same computer screen with the red cap, but they weren't allowed to look at porn. But as they monitored what was going on in their brain was seeing red baseball cap. This is what you do. You look at porn when you see a red baseball cap. So they had habituated themselves and sort of created a nudge for themselves in this study. And so there's ways you can structure your life to nudge you towards the right behavior. Nudges in and of themselves aren't going to solve your problem. They're not enough. But physical cues in the spaces you live in send messages to your brain, to your imagination, that you're often not consciously aware of. And a way to pick up on how some of these things work for you, there's a process called chaining or reverse journaling. So you start at the moment where you've given in to the temptation, you've caved, and you work back through your day. And so maybe your day was stressful at work, and you come home, and you don't want to look at porn because it's a stressful day, you want to do something else, but your living room is a mess from the night before, so you don't want to clean your living room, you don't want to be in your living room, so you head upstairs, your iPad's there, before you're laying on your bed looking at it, curtains are closed, all these things have cued you up to kind of work a certain, to looking at porn, and giving in to temptation. So what this idea of reverse journaling or chaining is to go back and see where you can break the chains in your automatic behavior, the things that cue you or clue you in to behaving a certain way. So there's more practices, there's more practical things to say, but I do need to keep going. So I wanted to talk about patience, and I want to also talk about hope. How does hope get in? How does hope get into these context where we seem unable to act on our ideals, but only cave in to temptations. So if you're able to recall for a minute what sort of thoughts, if any, were going through your head before you gave into a temptation, take a moment, think about it. Things that regularly go through your head that justify the behavior. These sorts of thoughts that people think are called permissive thoughts, and it's vital to pay attention to our permissive thoughts. These thoughts run across a spectrum of excuses, from things like, it's no big deal, it's been a long day, I deserve this piece of cake, this is the last time, I promise, tomorrow I'm gonna change, tomorrow's gonna be different. So it starts on that end of the spectrum, but it moves to thoughts that can be significantly deeper and darker. Ones that not only justify our behavior and excuse our behavior, but begin to make implicit claims on us as people. Saying things like, I can't get over this. I'm too weak. This is just who I am. Let's take one of these darker permissive thoughts. I can't get over this. And imagine what sort of effects this pattern of thinking has on a person that plays in their head over and over, day after day, year after year. Inevitably, this sort of thought leads to despair. It closes the door on hope. Not only about the situation, but about the person themselves. And this, as this despair gets reinforced and intensified over time, it often gets darker. I can't get over this becomes I'll never get over this, which becomes there's no way for me to get over this, and then ends with something like I'll be like this forever. So over time, this permissive thought has not only gotten darker, it now claims to know something that it actually can't know. It claims to know the future. It has closed off the possibility of hope or change. So this pattern of thinking claims to know us best, and it actually speaks directly against us. I will be like this forever is not too different from hearing you will be like this forever. This is who you are. And again, this pattern of thinking has closed off the possibility of growth or change and has condemned you. What if this pattern of permissive thinking is wrong? What if you're not a foregone conclusion? What if this isn't actually true about you, or ultimately doesn't have to be true about you? And so if you hear little else tonight, I do want you to hear this, that these sorts of condemning permissive thoughts are not the voice of God. These are the words of your enemy. These are the words of the liar. These are the words of the devil. These are the words of your accuser. John the Apostle, in his first epistle, his letter, 1 John, says, "Whenever our hearts condemn us, God is greater than our hearts, and he knows everything." And this word "greater" that John uses is megas. It sounds like great. And it means bigger in size, but it also means more dignified, more grown up, more informed, and more vehement. It's passionate. And it says that God actually knows everything. So he knows what your permissive thoughts actually don't know. He knows the future, and he knows that there is the hope and the possibility to change. And so for hope to get in, we have to learn to speak back to ourselves, to not just listen to ourselves and listen to our permissive thoughts, but to speak back to our permissive thoughts and tell them the truth. And it's interesting, these permissive thoughts, they speak to us and they speak against us, which is actually the exact opposite of how John in his gospel understands the work of the Holy Spirit when he calls the Holy Spirit our advocate. Our advocate is, we've been placed in this sort of courtroom, and our advocate is someone who speaks not just for us when we can't speak eloquently, when we can't speak honestly, when we just condemn ourselves. The Holy Spirit speaks for us to God, telling the truth about us, that we're God's child, that this behavior doesn't separate us from the love of God. But the Holy Spirit also speaks to us. So it speaks for us and it speaks to us. And so learning to talk back to yourself is learning the things the Holy Spirit actually has to say to you. We could say more. I've talked for a while. And I want to end with just an encouragement to come out from underneath stairs, to develop patience, to develop hope, to be involved in your own life, and to come out onto the stage. And that's coming from a quote in Marilynne Robinson's book, Gilead, from this character, John Ames. I'm actually going to take it away because I want you to hear it, and then you can read it later. That says this, Calvin says somewhere, that's John Calvin for any of my Calvinist friends out here. I hope that's our prayer alarm. Calvin says somewhere that each of us is an actor on a stage, and God is the audience. That metaphor has always interested me because it makes us artists of our behavior. And the reaction to us might be thought of as aesthetic rather than morally judgmental in the ordinary sense. How well do we understand our role then? I like Calvin's image, though, because it suggests how God might actually enjoy us. I believe we think about that far too little. But it would be a way into understanding essential things, since presumably the world exists for God's enjoyment. I'm going to end there and pull that quote back up and encourage you to think about the fact that God might actually enjoy you and that you can be an artist of your behavior. And so at this point, we'll do question and response. You're free to go. Thank you for listening. But the floor is open. So. Those are the rules, actually, everyone. Before you leave, you have to clap. And then, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, it's open floor. What's your name, by the way?
Brett.
Brett, yeah. Thanks for coming out on a Friday night.
Can you speak a little bit to just kind of the, just amplify maybe the community side of it and the response of the church? I mean, this is overwhelming. It's like a plague.
Yeah, epidemic.
I'm struck by really the silence in comparison to the problem of the church overall.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that or what your observations are of that, or as you read this material from both secular sources and Christian sources?
I think there's plenty of space to talk about it, and I think how would I go into this? I mean, I think there's any number of ways for a church community to make themselves a place where it's easier to talk about your struggles and not have them exist on this sort of hierarchy of disgust, where if you say you're addicted to porn or you've looked at porn for years, it's like, and I think that some of this neurological research actually is helpful in that way, because it shows, I think it helps explain to people in one sense why they can't get away from things they hate, which is, to some extent, you know, Paul talks about why I do the things I don't want to do. And so I think there needs to be more conversation. I mean, statistically, it's not a man's problem anymore, and so churches tend to treat it like it's a guy's problem. And I think some of those guy groups tend to more or less only talk about lust and porn and sexuality, and they get together and talk about it, and it's sort of all they talk about, and it doesn't make relationships between men be about anything more than just we're warriors in this fight against lust and that we're accountability partners or something. So, I mean, statistically, from what I've read, 30 to 40% of women struggle with pornography as well, and or at least regularly look at it. So I've just sort of rambled a bunch of things. But I think beginning a conversation and beginning it not just with the guys, but on a Sunday morning or at some other open event for other people, have conversations where people can begin to talk about it and not have it exist at the, like, pinnacle of, like I said, like, revolting things that guys do. Yeah.
Just thinking, sort of brainstorming, even, I was really struck by the quote from the high school student saying, like, this is where you can learn about sex. There's nowhere else to learn about this. And, you know, what if there were a handful of brave people who talked to 12-year-olds about sex and not just, these are your reproductive organs, you know, but talked more transparently about it. And it's like young people really need to see appealing marriages too, and that at least have some inkling of a exciting sex life.
I spoke at a mom's group about this. I spoke for 2 weeks. It was an interesting experience. And I mean, the second time I spoke, like, I don't know, like a little over halfway through the second talk, one of the women was more or less like, okay, we've heard enough. What do we do for our, like, she was like, okay, this is great. I don't actually need any more from you. I need to talk. And I found people want to talk about it and want to talk about it in ways that aren't filled with, I don't know if stigma is the right word. So, I mean, there's a whole slew of interesting, like, I always find I think of documentaries as good ways to sort of begin a conversation, or you hear different perspectives on things. And there's, what was the one we watched with Ryan? We were trying to screen it at our church, but our church has changed buildings and it's a little crazy. But
I can't remember the title. It's out of Canada.
Yeah, this and that website, Fight the New Drug, has tons of things. So just finding things for people to watch and think about collectively, and then begin having discussions. I mean, it's hard too because it's something that often it's a secret husbands keep from their wives, or wives keep from their husbands, kids keep from their parents. That New York Times Magazine article had another stat on they surveyed families and they asked the parents, how many of you think your kids are looking at porn? And then they asked the kids, how many of you are looking at porn? And most of the parents said, no, my kids aren't looking at porn. And most of the kids say, yes, I'm looking at porn and my parents have no idea. So finding ways to have conversations, I mean, my son is 7, and 2 years ago, we went to a Christmas Lessons and Carols service, and it talked about, and the virgin shall be with child. And he was like, what's a virgin? And I was like, oh, we'll talk about it later. And, you know, he sort of, because it was like, we were in the service, I couldn't, at the time, and then... But then the next day I had the opportunity, do I follow up with this or do I just sort of let it slide? So I decided to follow up, and he was 5 at the time. And, you know, I was like, hey, you remember you asked this question about what a virgin is? And he was like, okay. And so then I said, you know, I describe what sex is with genitals, because he knows men have penises and women have vaginas. And I said, and then that's where the seed goes into the mother, the sperm goes into the mother. I didn't use any. I don't think it's good to use. You have to use specific names, no nicknames for privates. And then I was like, do you have any questions? And he was like, well, what about Spider-Man fighting? Like, he was like, cool, whatever, moving on. But I do think if these numbers are true, if 11 is the earliest or is the average age, that means kids that are significantly younger are also being exposed to it. And so I think the days of the birds and the bees are done. I think it's multiple, like, there's no one more sex talk. There's, like, multiple conversations that need to happen from young age that I think get more appropriate as children get older and answer specific questions. Because... one of the things I said to the moms group was, like, if you don't want to talk to your kids about sex, the internet would love to, and is more than happy to, and eventually will. And so I don't know, I'm moving now towards young people, but having contexts where families and children and people, can have honest conversations, which again, I think some of the scientific, social science and brain science stuff allow a way in that isn't so predictable and moralistic. So those are just... So do you have any thoughts? I just talked for a long time. I'm sorry.
Well, my observation... That's great. That's great. I'm struck by... The more I understand this... And I'm coming from... I'm a recovering sex addict. Porn addict. So I'm 3.5 years into my recovery. And struck by, as I've come out of the drug-induced stupor that I've been in for decades. It started when I was 6.
No.
I look around, I just see the carnage.
Yeah.
And I go, holy cow. I mean, it would be a kind of thing if this was just, if it was visible in some other form, we would all be screaming, you know, just like the carnage. You know?
Yeah.
So, I'm saddened by the silence of the church in this, relative silence of the church in this as a whole. And I kind of suspect it has to do with just that that, I mean, if the statistics I've read are true, that our leadership, our pastors are struggling with this as just as much as the problem. Yeah. So that creates a dichotomy, it creates a structure in which either the individuals leading the churches are either struggling with themselves and are just destroyed by the shame of it, or don't want to address that. Or there are some that don't struggle at all with that, and they don't understand the shame of it. So either way, it's kind of a lose-lose. And I think the other thing is, I think men, as you touched on, become too siloed in this. Like we've said, hey, we'll go talk about this.
Yeah.
I really think this is a subject for men and women to come together with and say, hey, we need to together fight this, because it is decimating our marriages, it's hurting our children, it's destroying our culture. It's a bigger issue than a moral issue. I like how you paint that in a bigger... This is about loving our culture, loving our world. If we love our world, we won't let this ravage through here, like this virus.
Yeah.
Amen.
I would love to know of... I've put out feelers in different churches or with different people. I'm just curious how people in churches have these sorts of conversations.
I drove this far to have this conversation.
And a cookie. Hopefully you got a cookie too.
This isn't being talked about. I think they were close to what the in balance with the severity of the issue.
Thank you. Marty, you've had your...
I read the Sunday Times magazine article on teens. This is where teens are learning that sense. And it's really, really depressing. And just wondering, when you say now parents need to talk to their kids about sex at much earlier ages than we ever thought. Well, it seems like we need to talk to them about porn. How would you, warn them? Kids are doing a paper, a school paper, and innocently pops up where it is. And I just wonder how you suggest talking about that and what you do.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably context dependent. When I spoke to the moms group, I was so impressed with some of the moms, because one of the moms said we refinished our kitchen so that our kids would have a space to, all of them would have a space to work downstairs. No computers upstairs. Doesn't matter how loud the younger siblings are, you have to deal with it. One mom told me that was really sad, but her daughter was in seventh grade. And there's some reason why porn had come up, and she was going to talk to her daughter about it, and she was like, oh, I know what it is. The boys look at it on their phones in the back of the bus. I don't totally know if I have a great answer other than, you don't want to say too much too soon, but we listen to NPR in the car, and I feel as though more and more I'm shutting off NPR because I'm not against the Me Too and all the sexual scandals that have come up. I just don't want to explain that to my kids, right, or explain, yes, the president has had this connection with this porn star or... this doctor who works on Olympic, there's all of these things. So I think if your kids are connected, they're going to find out, I should have put some more slides up. There's a website, called Triple X Church. So just xxchurch.com. And they have guides to walk through talking to your kids with, as well as Fight the New Drug. I printed out their one and gave it to the moms about having the talk is what they called. But both of them say you can't just have a talk anymore. You have to have lots of talks. And it's interesting. It's just, I think it's also the best, what is it? This is some sports thing. The best offense is good defense. Is that right? And both, maybe? Yeah, yeah. Does that sound right, Vance? No? Maybe? I don't know. But that Triple X Church one, also, anytime there's a, they walk you through apps that can or can't bring porn onto your phone or your kids' phones. They walk you through any sort of new devices that are like video game stuff. I'm just clueless on this stuff, like Roku or something and all these other things that can, and they walk you through what it does and how it can or can't. But I mean, I think parents shouldn't let kids have phones. I mean, our son doesn't know the password to the iPad. Someday he will, he should, but at this point he doesn't. I'll say this. I really like this book for families. This is a book called The TechWise Family by Andy Crouch. And his, this is, I think, the second week in a row I've actually brought it up at a lecture here. And his chapter, on porn, comes 160 pages into it. And it's pretty short because the point of his book is to not just let technology, like to use technology wisely and to, as a family, be about something other than just being entertained. And so he says, if you guys have a fuller life together as a family, you model that for your kids. Like that's already like half the battle or more than half the battle. And there's all sorts of very practical things, in here as well. But yeah, I don't know. Anybody else want to? Nikki, you want to?
I think just it has to be in a broader conversation with your kids about what is sex, what it means to be a person in your body, and answering the questions they're asking about what bodies are for.
Yum.
And so that their first exposure to sex isn't violent or isn't.
Yeah. Or isn't just virtual.
And this woman, the same mom's group, came to talk. Her name is Nora Shine. About protecting your kids from sexual exploitation. But it first talks about, like, basically zones. Like, what's the red zone? What's the yellow zone? So the kids themselves know, I'm not comfortable in this situation.
No.
And I can go first to my mom and dad and tell them, I don't like this. Or this seemed funny to me.
Yeah.
And that there's always a conversation about your body with your kids of what is right and what is wrong, or if they have an intuition to go to first a safe person. And I think porn, for so many kids, they don't have a person that they can go and say, is this right? Or there's so much shame and
confusion.
So much assumption that, they'll find out. They'll go to sex ed in ninth grade.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But I remember Oprah, that I think Nora Shine talks about this. Oprah interviews a pedophile and she says, he's a coach. He was a soccer coach. And he said, I'm much more comfortable talking about sex with your child than you are.
Yeah.
And just the fear that parents have talking to their kids. And just the warning of there's other people very ready to talk to your child about sex.
Yeah.
It's interesting that one of the youth pastors at Park Street Church several years ago, I don't think he's there anymore, but I remember him saying that the parents all thought it was his job to talk to kids about sex, and they didn't want to. So, your job, you're the youth pastor, you talk to our kids about sex, so we don't have to. And yet, all the research has shown.
This was university age students.
These were college kids. I didn't think they were really.
That's a long time ago.
But this was a while ago. But the research, all of the research at the time showed that kids really wanted to learn about from their parents. Kids preferred, they wanted their parents to talk to them. And yet their parents were, as they said, scared.
Mary Frances? Yeah.
Two things. One, just back to the church thing. I think the church just does a very poor job of talking about sex, period. To kids, forget pornography. the church just doesn't talk about sex well at all. And I think that I
and some of you guys know, a couple weeks ago, I participated on a panel about sexual harassment at my church. And in preparing for it and some of the questions that went out, one of the questions is like, you know, it's just as much a problem in the church as it is out of the church. But you see all the, you know, just denials and scandals and all the stuff. And I think there's a sense where I think that, I mean, some churches do it very well, but I think for the most part, the church is quite uncomfortable with talking about humans being sexual beings. Mm-hmm. So whether we're talking about pornography, whether we're talking about sexual harassment, whether we're talking about homosexuality, whether we're talking about premarital sex, like it's sort of the only context that's talked about, and it's like, well, get married and then you can have sex and then it's awesome. But that's not what you see. To Sarah's point, you see people in marriages really struggling, people in marriages struggling with pornography and infidelity, all these things. And so I think it's just not talked about at all. And I think it is connected, as Nikki says, to just what it means. I mean, it's also talking about what does it mean to be human.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I wanted to say is, and I like went off about this in the workers' meeting the other day, but I've just been thinking with all of this so much about just the idea of so much of what Scripture calls us to, that what God is calling us to is this idea of neighborliness, of this, you know, love God and love your neighbor. I mean, those are the commandments, and that God has rescued his people not just for the sake of themselves, but for the sake of the whole and of the kingdom. And we are called to participate and to co-labor with God in his kingdom. And just the idea of what you were talking about, just like participating in your own life, showing up in your own life and stepping out. I mean, I love what you said about like volunteering at a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter. I mean, there's a piece of that that's just also getting beyond yourself, aside from all of the making yourself uncomfortable and all that. But I think that, and we see this at LaBrie, but I see just so much just passivity. People who are just passive in their own lives. And not to say that passivity causes addiction, pornography, or whatever, but I think there is a sense of being able to step out and to participate in something that is bigger than you are, which is what God's calling us to, and how, you know, what we do in private doesn't just affect us in private, it affects our neighbors in big ways and small ways, and God is calling us to a culture and a life of neighborliness. And I think back to the church, individualism is just as rampant in the church as it is outside of the church. So I don't know that we do neighborliness that much.
I'm just coming back to the church again. Different thoughts. I spoke different material, but the same topic to a college group a couple of years ago, and that was a mixed room. It wasn't like it was a Christian group, but it was like half Christians, half not. And as we were talking about it, I just realized to some extent how exhausting the hookup culture is, and how it presents itself in this cynical way, like, this is what it is. Look, this is who, like, we're, like, this is just what it is, you know, there's a Vanity Fair article about Tinder that came out around that same time, and it ends with the woman who was doing the interviews about Tinder and all the hookup culture, and how hookup culture is shaped by the scripts they get in porn. But she's sitting on a sorority front porch with these women on a Sunday afternoon after they've all partied and hooked up the night before, and she asks them about an orgasm. You know, like, what's it like to have an orgasm? And they laugh, and they say there's no, like, that's just not what's offered us, like, in this. And for them, the whole sexual culture is exhausting. And I just think about how appealing on some, especially if it's presented the right way, how appealing and what a relief, like, intimacy could be, and to be vulnerable and to be safe. And, I think the, like, sex shows up very, very early in the Bible. And the first command is to be fruitful and multiply. And God calls man and woman being together, like, very good. And there's more that can be said about it, but I think the Bible isn't just a series of prescriptions on when and where, but I think the Bible is very sober. Like, it understands that, like, you can't just have sex with someone and then walk away and think it hasn't done anything to you. Like, I think eventually reality pushes back, as we sometimes say around here. And it has a really sober take that this energy that makes two and makes them one, it's really significant, and something happens to you when you have sex with someone, and let marriage is sort of what holds that crazy atomic energy from, you know, going whatever. And it's a good thing. It's a good context for life. And I just wonder if at some point, especially, I mean, we have a lot of owning up to our own problems, not just the Catholic Church, but in the Protestant Church as well. But I wonder if at some point people will say, like, this sounds fairly sane, where my life feels exhausting and insane.
It strikes me that this is both this, you know, this very difficult topic, obviously, for the church as a whole. It's wrought with all kinds of emotion and triggers and things, but it's also presented itself, I think, as you speak, and it dawns on me, and I'm trying to develop this in my own thinking, it's one of the most wonderful opportunities for evangelism the church can have since, you know, going back into the city, and again, if this is a play, to say, do we stay, and do we help bring our culture and our friends and our neighbors out of this, or do we stand, or do we push away from it and moralistically say, I told you so, mm-hmm. You should have listened to us. And
yep.
I think that's
disinfected.
Yeah, often. And so it is just this, because the world is catching up, right? We're seeing how, you know, everything sown from so long ago is catching up in our culture and our world, where it's like this whole, what we sold out to in the 50s, the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, there's fallout.
There's fallout from the sexual revolution.
And now the
temptation might be from the church to say, see, we told you, though we're just as infected. But really, I think the Christ-like thing would be to do is say, how do I come? How do I wash your feet? How do I take care of you? Let us show you that there's a solution to this. No strings attached. You can just see this healing that can come in the context of this relationship with Christ and an authentic relationship. You know, porn addiction is an intimacy disorder. It's like, mm-hmm. for anybody, it doesn't matter what your creed is, you know, and just to give another model. It's a great, it could be an amazing evangelistic effort and tool.
Yeah. Thank you. Ben, yeah.
Just respond to that. In order for it not to be a finger pointing, I told you so, sort of exercise, that there has to be a conversation within the church that is going on in the church. So that it will not turn into this, here's some Christians kind of bringing their solution to my problem, rather than this is a problem that everyone is affected by. I just wonder what you were saying earlier, Joshua, about the one of the reasons why it's never spoken about in church is because it's something that everyone is hiding from somebody else sitting next to them in the pew, you know, whether it's a wife or a husband or a parent or a child, and how, because in general there is probably a heftier stigma in the church because of biblical sexual ethics, not that it's devoid of shame outside the church, but there's another aspect to the shame in the church. It's I imagine it's very, very hard to get a congregation of people to a place of honesty. People don't want to be the first person to step out and say, hey, anyone want to talk about porn addiction? Anybody? Oh, I guess it's just me, you know. I think, I don't know, but I just think, if the conversation does happen, it has to be so of a piece with a conversation about grace And that, you know, we talk about grace in this church all the time. We talk about God's unmerited favor, God's mercy, us not being able to earn God's approval. Anyway, well, guess what? This is where it's wrote. Like, this, do we believe in grace enough to be honest with each other about our pornography addiction? And if grace isn't emphasized and isn't given legs, like actually demonstrated, it's hard to imagine that anyone's ever going to be honest about it in the church. It's just more shame and more pretense.
Yeah. Tom, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I'd like to pick up a little bit on what Sarah and Mary Francis said. Pornography is a counterfeit. The normal way, one normal way of fighting a counterfeit is to immerse yourself in the real. Mm-hmm. Not to spend your time studying the counterfeit and saying what's wrong with it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that can go for cults, it can go for liquid, for counterfeit money. And long before the internet was around, the church was failing to deal with healthy sexuality. Yeah. And what I'm puzzled, a couple of things. Sarah, a couple of weeks ago, talked about creativity. And she listed four or five things that were high experiences. Creativity itself, religious ecstasy, music, sports, and sex. And here it is, one of these invigorating high life experiences, mm-hmm. and there's no place for kids to turn to even see it modeled. Yeah. And I wonder about this because first I'm puzzled because if you read the Gospels, Jesus basically says, "I forgive you, go and sin no more." And reading the four Gospels, I don't think you can just the four Gospels. I don't think you can figure out that sex and children go together. I'm not sure, but I don't think you can find any place where Jesus connects sex with children. Just puzzling. But but what I'd like to go to is the Puritans, from what I've listened to historians of the church. The Puritans in New England asked the question, you know, because of the gospel, how do I live 7 days a week? What does this tell me? How does this tell me? And there was I think it was the Lancaster Congregational Church had a history written, and then it was rewritten in the 1890s by the Victorians. And it was prefaced by, so as to not offend modern sensibilities, we have edited much of what was written down in the original church. Because they were too graphic, or too, not graphic is the wrong word.
Racy.
Well, they were racy and straightforward. So-and-so and so-and-so did not forgave them and accepted them back in the church. They lived on farms. They knew the Victorian. When we say that's puritanical, we really often mean that's Victorian.
Yeah, you're right.
And so I guess I'm raising the question is that the reason I brought up the Gospels and Jesus is somehow or other the Puritans were able to connect grace and the gospel, or made an attempt to connect grace and the gospel with being transparent about sexuality. And somehow or other, the Victorian age became uncomfortable with it, and I think we're stuck with that with the remnants to this day. And we claim we're open, but if, I mean, in the 60s, there were just, teenage films were always nervous and snickering about sex. It was never a healthy thing. It was always a shameful, snickering, joking.
Yeah,
sort of thing. So I don't know the answer here, but the church doesn't touch it at all.
Yeah. Does anyone want to add anything to that? Or were you going to say to Tom's comment? Or
when we're in Victoria, you can't blame her for that. Yeah. Even Victoria herself.
Well, I don't know much about her. She had three baths her whole life, I understand.
She had a lot of kids.
She had nine kids.
Lots of kids, and she loved her husband. And they enjoyed their sexual relationship.
Yeah, well, they called the Victorian age just because she was reigning, not because of her.
Yeah, yeah.
Some people would argue that it's not the Puritans were, in a sense, a different century, but
They were,
the,
yeah.
The descendants of the Puritans weren't as responsible for what you're describing as the Unitarians were, who had only morality to stand on. No theology to speak of, but only morality and the rigidity of moral performance. And literally came more out of the Unitarianism in the 19th century.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, that's one
thesis.
I'm sure Unitarians would dispute it.
that one angle is it. Takes it in that direction.
But certainly you look at people like Edmonds and these people, they're just totally down to earth about sexuality. It's very straightforward.
But would you agree that that was, by the 1960s, that was completely lost on most of the Protestant churches?
Go for it, Jack.
I'm going to tweak the subject a little bit. So you want to hang
this is one thing on that. The Puritans, the New England Puritans, they believed in early marriage because they, and of course people grew up much faster than they were. By 17, kids were working and holding down jobs and running farms, but also getting married because of the reality of sexual desire. Get married early. Get married soon. So I was going to go back to something that I didn't get your name actually.
But Brett.
Yeah, Brett. That's right. It's really interesting that in terms of the potential apologetics and the good news of Christian marital sexuality and so on. In the early church, the pagans actually wrote about Christians, or one of the areas in which Christians changed most dramatically when they were converted out of paganism into Christianity was in their sexual morality. And pagans looked at the Christians and marveled at their sexual freedom because they weren't being driven by their lusts the way the pagan world was. And the pagan idea was that, you know, Aphrodite, the goddess of love, would put a spell on you and drive you crazy. And the idea of Christians actually being chaste when they were single and monogamous when they were married was looked at by many pagans as being, there's some free, such an incredible freedom, which is something to really aim for in our own, you know, that we could model that. The other quick thing I was going to say was just thinking of, I was really struck by your graph on the eclipse and how pornography went down when people were watching the eclipse. And that just makes me think, you know, our son Tim, who's, you know, he's an environmentalist Christian and real believer in getting people outside and in enjoying God's creation.
Yeah.
And he always makes the point that Christians would the Bible actually says we need to look at creation to learn about God. But so many Christians ignore that, and you know, we would never think of not reading the Bible to our children, but the idea that God's creation is actually something that is endlessly exciting, and you can never get to the end of it, and
just in your imagination.
Yeah, it plays with your imagination. Getting us, it's one of those things of joy and imagination. And since I'm sure one thing that gets people into pornography and keeps them on it is boredom and not being engaged in positive things. And that's also come up, not being engaged in positive things with your family, whether it's the arts or music, but being outside. And you know, I know people who are exposed to the natural world when they're young and really encouraged, and they don't get bored because it's, it can go on.
Yeah.
Whatever, birds, stars.
Yeah.
Starting with a mud puddle with a little kid.
Dick, were you
going to? Yeah, just to swing a little direction. I wonder if you've run across this in your reading, Joshua. What is anything we can learn from smoking? From the fact that there really has been a change in smoking. Mm-hmm. And it's highly addictive. The enormous financial for the whole economy in it. Mm-hmm. And huge political clout of that tobacco world. What happened? It was a tremendous message. This is going to kill you. Over long years, but I mean, I can't remember for years I've been hearing that. But you'd still go to a medical center and you see doctors and nurses smoking. Not anymore. Or at least I don't see that much anymore. Somehow in the last 15 years, I don't know what anybody thinks.
smoking has really taken a hit. How did that happen?
It's
a message. It's very. Yeah. This is the talking about the culture as a whole. The connection, I guess, might have been simpler to make, although it sure took a long time. After we knew that tobacco was killing us, to have a penny drop and people actually stop. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder.
Well, it's starting to happen. I mean, there's a TED Talk on, I don't know if you've seen, there's a TED Talk where a guy starts talking about the difficulty of having a control group of young men, those who do and don't watch pornography. He says, well, there is a control group forming because of this pie thing you talk about.
Yeah.
There's a lot of young men experiencing erectile dysfunction from watching porn, and that is making a larger and larger number quit, according to a TED Talk.
But I've seen more negatively, with negative consequences come out just in the last year. Mm-hmm. I don't know, would you say that's, Joshua? What?
Negative consequences of what?
Of pornography.
Yeah.
I mean, they're getting the negative spin out of it. This New York Times thing is pretty sobering on the bad consequences of it, isn't it? That's mm-hmm. not the main subject of it.
Yeah.
I think one of the connections with smoking, Dick, is that in the last 10 years, it's actually much harder to smoke anywhere except like your car in your own home. They've passed these laws.
But that's because the conscience has changed first.
But I think it was also like this will kill you, and then I think there's all the message that like it can kill the people around you. I mean, your children breathing secondhand smoking and that stuff. And then it's like the big nudge factor in a way. It's like what Judge was talking about. It's like, well, if you can't smoke in a restaurant, you can't smoke on a plane, you can't smoke a bar, and you can't smoke within 30 feet of a building. You can't even, if you're a hospital employee, you can't just walk outside and smoke a cigarette outside the hospital. You have to cross the street and I think it's actually kind of tied to some of what Joshua was saying. Like there's a bit of the physical environment has changed that's just making it
At least under David Cameron, I don't know if it's changed in the UK. They changed. So you basically your router will not receive porn. I don't think it's as simple as like a porn switch, but it will not receive porn or access pornographic. Like that is the default setting in the UK unless you turn it on. And I know in Utah, where there actually is it's not as though the Mormon Church is exceptional in this. There's high percentage in the Mormon Church of porn use, but there's also there's more of an overlap between Mormon culture and sort of the political culture, I gather. I could be wrong, in Utah. And so there has been in Utah some steps towards, sort of legislating more restrictions on it, and I think where it's a little more slippery than smoking is because the lie of this is something you do in the privacy of your own home with no effect to anyone else. I think that still runs deep, and if we have a dogma in, Western culture is you have the right to be as sexual as you want, wherever you want, with whomever you want, as long as there's consent, which is...
As I understand consent,
which this article talks about how young people don't understand what consent is, which I thought was disturbing. So I know there's some... This book has an essay on the moral basis for legal regulation of pornography by a legal scholar. I think at this point it still is something that there's... I mean, porn is so big, and so many of our sort of media sharing technologies online, like porn has paved the way and is always ahead, whether it's streaming videos or even just sending images. The nature of things that are this large, it's not just pornographers, like sleazy guys and, bad suits, smoking cigars, you know, in somewhere in LA. Like, there's lots of large corporations that get pretty good kickback through these things, whether through different means. They talk about that in this book. So I think there's a lot of
Google, Facebook.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, they talk. Yeah.
You said that one of the biggest porn sites was free.
Yes,
so
free.
How do they make money?
Advertising. It's like YouTube. Mm-hmm. So it's basically YouTube for porn.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. And, yeah, they get a lot of traffic. And so that's, I mean, they're selling things. So there's people who want, if that many people are looking at these videos, I'd love, you know, my product to pop up. So, yeah, I mean, some of that stuff gets a little over my head in regards to how Rupert Murdoch or how whoever is, you know, making, you know, people make these connections between the porn industry and various people and, you know, getting money out of it. But
I think it's pretty quiet, you know, no, you know, folks in that standard aren't advertising there in the business. But if you you add up the revenue of all the this has been fact for a while, people say a lot, but it's just if you add up the revenue of all professional sports,
yeah,
in 1 year it does not match the revenue of pornography. If you think of all football revenue, all professional sports together, it still doesn't match that. So it's a Goliath in media, and as you said, it is what, you know, some have said it's why the web exists. The web, it owes itself to that because that was the driver of traffic and money. And
there's some, yeah, and there's some crazy stats that I can't remember off the top of my head. Our pastor told me them, but something like after 10 p.m., the amount, like what the internet is used for, is the majority is porn. I forget what the number is, so I don't want to say it. But yeah, it's a big reason why people are online. Or, you know, once you start using it online, using the computer for anything else is going to remind you that, like, oh, this is, you know, it pulls people in. Yeah.
I think New Drug has, like, the top 10 people who are, or top 10 industries that are making the most money from porn.
Yeah.
Like the Hilton Hotels,
yeah.
TD Mobile, American Apparel, Edie James, the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
Like, people that you're not, like, necessarily, like, oh, they're making money from porn. It's people where you go shopping. I mean,
it's also now, it's like Silicon Valley. Yeah. Like, it's moved away from, I think, hotel rentals to more just streaming and all those sorts of devices. But, yeah, Fight the New Drug has really, it's a wonder. I can put that picture back on. It is a great, they're good people, if I can find it.
Is that faith-based, or is that just...
So they are... the guy who runs it is named Clay, and he... There it is. He's a Mormon, and there's some funding that comes from the Mormon Church, but they don't say that they're... It doesn't come... They're like, we want to look at science and personal stories. It's all we... That's what we're drawing from here. But there is in the root. So, like, there's a lot, there's other websites that just.
Others.
Yeah, Fight the New Drug. There's other people that trash it because and say you can't trust any of their scientific findings because it's coming out of this, you know, religious moralism. Mm-hmm. But I don't think, from what I've read, I don't think that's true about Fight the New Drug. But yeah. Hey, Dave. Or Dave. Sorry.
Gotcha. I was talking to a student not too long ago. Struggling with addiction, and his way out was finding a 12-step type program.
Yeah.
And wondering in your readings, have you read on the success or failure rate of 12-step programs for porn? And is it different? Or and then your take, do you think there's something to learn there from 12-step programs, or and how would you do it differently?
So I'm sort of like, look, if it worked and it's working, that's great. Like, I'm happy because, like I said, I don't think there's a silver bullet or a single way. I have some questions about AA and some of their understanding about addiction and probably some reservations, I should say. So that aspect of some 12-step, but like there's all sorts of, like Fight the New Drug has, they call it the fighter program. And you become a fighter, and they, and there's another, a lot of these things are online. There's another one called NoFap, and FAP is just slang for masturbating. It's also, it's not faith-based, but it's people online in these communities that are trying to encourage one another. So it's not necessarily a 12-step, now that I'm saying that out loud, but I'm sure we have all sorts of things. I mean, whether I have reservations with AA or not, I have so much to learn from people that have gone through AA and or people that have just overcome addiction. So I would think there is something to learn. Is that a... I feel like I'm not sure I answered it.
Yeah. I was just thinking, like, the nature of addiction is pretty specific, and it has typical things that need to happen with a person and community, and just wondering what, if we're going to be salt and light in this way, what do we need to know about the nature of addiction and how a person actually finds healing what do we learn about that other than 12-step programs and obviously the books you've been reading, but on a practical, like, here are the like practical things you do to get out of addiction, this one in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one is I think porn addiction has a lot to do with patterns of avoidance, avoiding life and avoiding, because I mean, porn is easy and it's everywhere and it's just a few clicks away. And it obviously does more harm than just sort of relieving stress and discomfort. So, I mean, I think that's where trying to develop character or other virtues situated in sort of a larger project of being a person, and not just sort of zeroing in on it. But, you know, I think having all sorts of tools or resources to sort of figure out how it started, when it started, what was going on, and what's propelling it. Why does it continue to go? Because, I mean, I don't think there's one before, sort of in a different life, I worked in a social housing nonprofit in Vancouver. A lot of addictive people, and so many different stories that shatter any preconceived notions of why people are addicted to. And these were people that were intravenous drug users, smoking crack, all sorts of things. And, you know, for me, a common thread through them was pain. Like some difficult pain in life that they had no resource to deal with. Sometimes it's physical pain, which is, you know, I was painting and I fell off a ladder and broke my back, and I've not been in pain for the last 20 years, except if I do Dilatus, which is an artificial kind of heroin. And, that's a different, you need sort of a different approach to that than, someone who, you know, there's another guy in my building who was a UN peacekeeper in, Kosovo and saw all sorts of things that he doesn't want to have seen. And, you know, now he's living in Vancouver as a heroin addict. And so it's like, I think there's different things, and maybe that's part of the wisdom of some of the, I'm not as super familiar with 12-step programs, but some of the wisdom of having steps and guidelines that maybe certain steps are more important for you than other steps, but something to work with and work through. And I'm a believer in therapy. I'm a believer in counseling, whether that's with someone who has been credentialed as a sex therapist, or whether that's a pastor or a wiser, older person who's in your life, or someone. But I don't think there's a magic bullet, but there's all sorts of steps. And I guess going all the way back, that's a different thing. I don't want to say that. But yeah, I don't know. Do you want to say any more, or is there?
Yeah, no, I was just curious if that was, if 12-step programs are part of the discussion at all, or if they're just kind of, we're beyond that, or that, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they're beyond that. I just think there's just different people trying different sort of strategies, and like I said, different tools. So, but I think whatever happens, they have to happen in relationship. And so one of my struggles with AA is, apart from your sponsor, you're not necessarily connected long, like for the long haul, with this same group of people. Like, people drop in and out of AA, or, you know, come in and out of different AA groups, and the relationships revolve around. This is from talking to people who've gone to AA.
Yeah.
You know, the relationship revolves around drinking and not drinking. And
so it was like the accountability groups you're talking about earlier doing the same thing.
I think
talk about lust.
I think so. I mean, I don't know if that's always the case. This is anecdotal. I read some other studies that are less excited about AA for different reasons too. But so
what they have going for them is extreme transparency.
Yeah.
Which I've heard pastors say that who opened their basements to AA, they said, I wish the guys who meet upstairs on Sunday could see how those guys relate down here, and for the two will never mix. And the other funny thing is, I have a friend who went to many 12-step programs. I have no idea what for. He just went to 12-step programs. And he also went to he was not Brazilian, but he started going to some of the Brazilian churches in Somerville when they were having this major revival. And he said he had never met, when he went to AA, he said he'd never met people who knew so much about changing your character and so little about God, about God character. And then he went to the Brazilian church, he said he'd never seen, it was a Pentecostal, Pentecostal church, he said he'd never met some people who knew more about God and so little about changing their own character. He said the two of the, one was the inverse of the other.
Let's get these people talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a good point. Like, going back to what we were saying before, I mean, if one thing, I think you're really right, actually, about those, like, AA groups or 12-step groups is, I mean, you walk in and the first thing you say is, I think there's a sinister, not as positive side to this, but you walk in and you say, "Hi, I'm Josh, I'm an alcoholic." And it's like, you know, like, you put it out there. There's a vulnerability, there's a transparency, like you said.
There's a downside to that, but
I was going
to
say, yes.
There's an upside.
I think the downside is, because you're significantly more than an alcoholic.
Right.
But I don't know, just going back to the question about churches, how do churches create places where there's vulnerability?
So Celebrate Recovery is an example of a merger of 12 steps with kind of an undergirding Christian theology and connection between the steps and the gospel. And I think it's fairly effective. You tend to have a little more, the connection seems to be a little bit deeper. It's not just in and out. But I think and then there's groups like specific to sex addiction, Sexaholics Anonymous and things like that. There's groups tailored to the specific things. And I think, which then the principles are the same, the steps are the same, but the kind of the what's being talked about is specific to the addiction. There are specific issues with each addiction, I would imagine. I think the power of those groups is there's not just transparency of I am an alcoholic or I am sexually broken, but there's also the celebration of the chip. There's a celebration of I'm also overcoming this. I'm in recovery. So I think it would be unfair to say it's just the downside of that. There is the celebration of just like, hey, we're battling this together. I've been a part of some of those groups, and I can see some of the things that are kind of the downside. But overall, I think the church has a lot more to learn from them than anything else because of just people being real. I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, this group of folks are just they're able to, the grace that comes out of that is transformative.
Yeah, I've only ever been to a few, but I've gone with someone. I'm not an alcoholic. And I felt like it's kind of like that honesty or whatever, it's kind of contagious. You're like, oh wow, this is, disarming isn't the right word, but and it's, I don't know if refreshing is either, but there's something about it where you think, I'd like to be more honest too. That looks like it feels all right. Yeah. Hey, friend.
I just have a bunch of thoughts and questions just about what you're saying about people looking into porn and seeing that it's not so much necessarily about the sex and the lust, but also about the power and the violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for me, that's like a really scary thought, especially knowing how much of it is consumed. Mm-hmm. And so thinking like, is that how people, men are seeing me? Is that how women are seeing themselves? That we're just like meant to take all this, aggression and violence. And I guess I was just trying to think about how that connects in with what you were saying about porn being used as an escape or as a disengagement from life. Mm-hmm. Why then is it so violent? Like, why? Another part of the fall and that kind of wrestle between men and women and trying to get, or is it kind of like you quoted that man saying it's that kind of revenge against women who don't want to sleep with you?
That's a good question. I think there's, in a sense, I don't totally know, but the history of pornography in North America is really, really, it started with at least pornography in the public realm, or sort of being publicly acceptable, started with Playboy being published in the late 50s or early 60s, and it became huge, and then other people wanted to sort of get in on that, those profits. So then another magazine called Penthouse showed up, which had already, the guy who did it was already working in Europe at the time, where there were laxer kind of standards. And it started, and then there were sort of three big ones, Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler. And they, throughout like the 70s, I think it was in the 70s, it was what was called the pubic wars, and so it was just who was going to show full, because at that point it was just breasts, it was just like women, and then it sort of moved to full frontal nudity, but who was going to push the boundary, and so they just sort of were out raunching each other, pushing it a little more. So the nature of the industry is if you want some of this huge market, you just have to do something someone else isn't doing. It just from the beginning, the competition on the pornographer side was just pushing it further and more and more extreme. But that moved at a much slower pace when it was a magazine published monthly. And then at that point, there was sort of this pattern of more extreme pornography. And then the internet hit, in the mid late 90s or whatever the internet hit. And people were just assuming like this is what porn does. It gets more extreme. So like the consumer had been sort of primed to expect this, in this, a similar way to we expect higher standards in special effects and movies than we did 15 years ago. I think consumers had this unspoken expectation. This woman, Gail Dines, in the book Pornland, talks about this at length. But then I think that's like one sort of social explanation. But then I think too, if there is something to this neurological research, people like they get bored because it's not as exciting. The dose isn't as whatever these chemicals that are being released in the brain. They're not having the same effect until you find something more. And so it's interesting. There's a reading interviews with pedophiles, with people or people who were caught with child pornography in some of this stuff, which would often say things like, I didn't expect to do this, but I was clicking, looking for something. I didn't know what to look for. I was waiting, there's just story after story of people, of guys who just spent hours just clicking through images and videos, waiting for something that's gonna be new and different. And so that you're doing that, and then all of a sudden something really, you're looking for something different, and something like child pornography pops up. And you're like, whoa, that's gross. I don't want that. But then it's sort of, because it was a new thing where all the other things you've forgotten, that one sticks in your head in some unique way. And so anyway, it's just sort of, I think, the nature of, we want a new stimulus to sort of recreate those moments. And and this is just the route it went. It went to be just very aggressive and dominating, and, you know, hearing this guy's, Bill Margold, this guy, his comment. So I don't know. I see some of those dynamics that are at play, but that's where it's now, especially now, when some 9-year-old boy is like looking on his dad's iPad and finds this, like he doesn't know what he's looking at, you know? But that it's far down a continuum or a spectrum or something like that. But that's where it sort of, that's where it can start. And then,
and I guess, like, too, from what I've read on these things, like, about the new drugs, about the different categories of porn that have become more and more popular, and things like into family relationships.
Yes, yeah.
And that's just, I don't know, that really concerns me a lot.
Yeah.
It's just like, I guess, in the world, it's about, you know, our actions come out of what's inside us, and if this is what's in people's minds.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are. I mean, it's a hard thing, I think, for people to get funding for, as well as hard thing for people to for people doing some sort of social scientific research. But there are people that have researched connections between pornography and then sexual violence, But yeah, so Fight the New Drug puts out porn hubs. Not only do they put out these infographics, but they also Pornhub puts out, yeah, most viewed or like most searched for. They go state by. I mean, they put out hundreds of infographics. You know, what was the most searched for thing?
Pornhubs
themselves do this. Yeah, and most searched thing in Iowa, most searched that, you know, in Indonesia, like, because it's a worldwide thing. And yeah, I didn't put it on because I didn't want to talk about it, but it's disturbing about, yeah, where sort of sexual fantasies go, and for people, the chicken or the egg, like what came first, you know. I think anyway, yeah, but yeah, it's. Again, that's where I think at some point there has to be, I guess Ross Douthat wrote a thing about it's time we need to start regulating porn in response to this New York Times Magazine thing. I didn't read it yet, but you told me about it. But I think at some point, like, maybe I'm naive or hopeful, like at some point, even someone who's thoroughly convinced of it, I'll say this. The thing that seems to get people to stop looking at porn is the fact that they can't have sex. Like, they get this porn-induced erectile dysfunction. Or they have a pre-existing belief about the nature of human sexuality, like people of faith do, the Christian faith or other faith, that would say, no, this is not, this is an imitation, this isn't real. But it seems as though the only thing that gets people to stop is them not being able to have sex, which a lot of your brain on porn and the nofap stuff talks about. But I do wonder if at some point people are going to say, oh, like the third most, you know, searched porn category was like stepson or stepmother. Like at some point people are going to say, should we stop some of this? Like, is this so, like at some point I want to think public conscious, to whatever extent it exists, would be like, this can't be good. This can't be neutral. Like, this can't be in the privacy of your own home. Or Dick.
I was going to say, back to the denomination side, I'll throw a theological interpretation into your
Yeah, please.
Which is, I don't have time to lay. But as I read Genesis, one of the main things that we are as images of God is those who are able to have dominion over the earth, which is mastery, exerting our energy to shape it or to prevent shape from happening, whatever. A hugely important dynamic about what it is to be human. That's not the only dynamic, but we'll leave it there for the moment. But then you have the fall, and I think suddenly the world is a dangerous place and an unsafe place. And dominion after the fall tends to become domination in order to deliver the sense of safety and well-being and so on in the world. So in other words, a radically ramped up and exploitive version of dominion is just the norm, I think, of what we do to a God-given capacity for dominion. It's misusing our imageness of God. And so I think power is a huge means by which we buttress our sense of self, our sense of security. And here it could be any millions of different angles, but I think this is very much behind the dominance of women. It's weird that it's such a spin-off from sexuality, that sexuality is almost the occasion for this. Now, but I think we're dealing with something very, very humanly deep, is what I'm trying to say. And that's very basic to who we are. It's wrenched out of shape. Anyway.
And then you add to that the Genesis 3:16 prediction of a gendered part to the fall. Her desire will be for the man, he will rule over her. This is a broken relational thing. And boy, you see that in extreme form. You see it in all kinds of areas, and like abuse and so on, but in foreign domination. Giving the appearance that she's desiring.
There's a guy at the English Library. You should listen to every lecture he's ever given because they're all wonderful.
What's his name?
Jim Paul. I think.
What a
plug. Yeah. You should send him all your money. And he gave a talk on pornography. And one of the things he talked about that I thought was very helpful or insightful was, so there's this Jewish philosopher guy named Martin Buber, who he talks about there's various types of relationships, like an I-thou relationship, where you see yourself in relation to another person, a thou, and then we turn that, and it becomes an I-it. But he says, in sort of a technological age, we've lost the I-thou to an I-it, we've lost the person, but it's just I-me. It's like everything just reflects back on us, and we lose not just in pornography, but we just lose the capacities to be an empathetic person when we're just typing mean things on YouTube videos or living our life online where we can attack someone and there's no consequence. We don't see like when I was a kid, if I said something mean to you on the playground, I would see you cry. Where now if you say something mean to someone on Facebook or whatever, you don't see them cry anymore. It just, so you don't build that sort of thing. And there's something about technological culture that just doesn't allow you. I mean, there's wonderful things about technology. I'm not anti-technology, completely, but it does reinforce these sort of mental patterns that, like, things exist for me, and they're not really other people. And they're there, but they're just not as important. And so I think one of the reasons people just, when you live a whole life online, you can become really calloused to even perceiving these things as being so domineering, so abusive. So I think it's, I want to just somehow connect it to that as well, to people just living their life online and not knowing how to engage with people or how to read things that are false and read things that are inhumane. So anyway, that was just a thought. But Jim Paul is It's great. Decision-making in the will of God. Everyone should listen to it.
Decision-making what?
He has a lecture called Decision-making in the will of God. Anyway. Okay. Yeah. Marty, did you want to say something?
An example of that was our son Chris, when he was a probation officer, was dealing with a kid in a locker facility who'd been shot. And the kid was outraged that it hurt. It never occurred to him. He'd seen so many pictures on television and movies and videos, whatever, of people getting shot. It just never occurred, it never connected him that actually would cause pain to somebody.
Yeah.
So when he got shot and it hurt, he was outraged and surprised and
But I guess I also do want to say at the same time, and I said this earlier, like, I think people who start looking at porn get significantly more than what they're signing up for, and significantly worse. And I don't think people know, I mean, it's the same thing with other hard drugs. You don't start using drugs hoping you'll end up being, you know, homeless or losing all your friendships. Like, that's not what the deal is, or what you think the deal is. So I think from conversations with people, like, I think people are even disgusted with the stuff that arouses them because they've habituated themselves. And so I still think people can change. Like, I don't believe people are turned into these monsters, from porn. I think porn gives them these false scripts that they internalize and gives them this, it starts changing the structure of their brain, and it hooks them, and they hate it, but they keep going back. And so I think people want, not all people, but at least some people want a way out and want to know that, like, sex doesn't have to be something that you kind of, You sort of hate your own, you know, you hate this part of yourself. You're so hooked in these things that you don't like but arouse you. Like, that's a very confusing, vulnerable place to be. It's not, I have much less sympathy with pornographers, people that make this stuff. But I do think I know there's hope. I mean, one of the things I love about the Fight the New Drug website is there's just stories after story after story of people who stop for different reasons and through different means. And
Josh, I was going to say something to that. I mean, in some respects, when you consider the progression and the expediency of it, it's so discouraging. On the other hand, it seems to me that some of the research that's coming out now, I mean, it's fairly new. It's in the last, like, 8-10 years that's looking particularly at sort of the neurological damage and the pathways that are being formed and such. And even though it may not be necessarily for the right reasons or the most altruistic reasons, people will change, are probably more inclined to change when out of selfish motives.
Yeah, sure.
And so if they're looking at some of this and saying, wow, this is what I'm doing to me, back to Dick, you brought up smoking. There was a public consciousness that changed, but I think initially a lot of it was learning about the health risks, the personal risks, and even, you know, to others. So if this is, and I think you were talking earlier about, well, we hope we're hitting this tipping point here, and maybe even some of the new research and literature that's coming out is showing people, if you're on this, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
You're in trouble. And of course, there's a lot better reasons for people to break the pattern, but if they break it for the less than the best reason, that's good.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and one of the most, like, so, I mean, I looked at porn for years, and a friend of mine, her father was dying of cancer, and he had been a sex addict, and he cheated on his wife for years, looked at porn. And his wife knew it and stuck with him. He got cancer. His life changed. And lots of things changed. He met with a therapist. He came back to his Christian faith. Like, he died of cancer. But she was this amazing, amazing woman. And so she was walking with her dad and said, you know, like, what? You know, you've been free of this stuff for a couple of years, you're going to die. Like, I don't know what's changed, like, in the world? Like, what's changed, you know, what keeps you, what made you decide, besides the fact you're going to die, like, what made you decide to do this? And he said the world had lost all of its color, and since stopping this, I never knew there were so many colors. Mm-hmm. Like, which was just, for me, I was like, whoa, like, that's a different way to sort of compel someone not to just say, you're going to die, but, like, you're actually not living, you're not getting what's being offered. You're missing out on something that's real, the thing you were talking about, that you mentioned, Tom. And so
That's universal, too. That regardless of, you don't have to be a follower of Christ to be able to experience that.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the apologetic we have in to move away from this, I think. And why we can align as a church with people outside the church to fight this. I think that's a huge mistake I see is like, well, you know, again, we want to sound, it's about us.
Yeah.
And yet there are these wonderful voices, you know, that are one of the really terrific book called Out of the Doghouse is about husbands and repairing marriage relationships. Mm. It's written by a gay man.
Hmm.
But
yeah.
It's spot on. He's an expert in this area in terms of porn recovery from porn.
Yeah.
And what a resource to lose, where there could be this alignment, like we should find these alignments within the world where we can. And there's some areas where we won't be able to agree with you, but where we can agree and let's fight for the greater good.
We use a phrase around here. We say co-belligerence. Francis Schaeffer's.
Belligerence without being an ally.
Yeah. So finding, exactly, like you just described it. And, I mean, this woman, Gail Dines, is, I'm not sure where to find the book again. She is, a leading anti-porn, I think I'm going the right way, anti-porn expert. She runs this site, and, she speaks at churches. She's not a person of faith. She's pretty, very progressive. She's, being a feminist means all sorts of different things.
She has to fight battles with her own camp.
Yeah. But she's Australian, and she works with this organization. She's in Boston, but she's Australian. And she works with this organization for the Center for Public Christianity in Australia. And she's on lots of issues, whether it's, same-sex marriage or abortion or, any number of things. She falls pretty, she's decidedly has a different take. But she's happy to work with anyone who's willing to talk about this together. And so I think, if Christians aren't doing it, at least non-Christians are doing it. And, or some of them are, but Ben?
A question about sort of, in the realm of what Fran was talking about. Has anyone been writing or talking about the connection between just extensive porn use and the Me Too movement? Basically, like the actual sexual abuse that's been going on, but is been hidden, but is coming out. There's understandable and good public outrage at a lot of these things that have been happening. And yet, part of the whole question is the comparing it to smoking, and like we're kind of finding out how deep our commitment to sexual freedom is. How much of an idol is sexual freedom in our culture? Are we willing to tolerate all this stuff? In the name of sexual freedom? No. I mean, I think people are hugely conflicted. Like, this is horrible, but whatever you do in the privacy of your room is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if that's contributing to this brutal behavior?
There's been some stuff on Fight the New Drug. I don't know anything on a sort of scholarly level or, I mean, it's such a new, the Me Too thing is so new, but talking about these cultural contradictions, and talking about, this is a big blind spot to, and you know, there's movements of, I mean, the New York Times Magazine talks about it briefly, and most of these books do, about like different sort of feminist porn that's sort of turning the tables on these scripts of domination. They're not very popular. You have to pay for them. And they sort of are niche, but they're trying to give, you know, I don't know, it's a weird way to put it, but they're like a voice of in the wilderness of saying, like, look, porn is still good, and it doesn't have to be so anti-woman. In fact, it's pro-woman, and but it's just...
That smokes cigars instead of cigarettes.
Yeah, it seems like that just plays fine into the male role. They're like, okay, that's fine. You let us do our thing. You do your thing. We'll, you know, like, it still works in fine. But, yeah, Fight the New Drug has talked a little bit about it, but I don't, beyond that, I don't know. I mean, it's one of the things, like, so, like, Fight the New Drug had a feature with James Franco because he is anti-porn. He's on this TV show about, he's some sort of pimp in New York in the 70s, I think. And he's met a lot of women in the industry through this role and has said, like, I don't want anything to do with it anymore. And then a month later, he gets a Golden Globe and then he's also accused. So it's one of the, yeah, it's one of the, they, there's a, yeah, so. Yeah, so I'm not totally sure. But yeah, Mary Frances, do you know? Or?
I would say, how could it not?
Right. Well, that's.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's about men doing what they want and men's power and domination. So, I mean, directly or indirectly, I think, how could it not? And it reminded me of something. Joshua, what you said about a lot of the, I can't remember if this was all porn or just, or just that where there's violence towards women, which is 90% of it. But you said where the response of the women in the films is like either pleasure or neutral. This is a little bit of a jump, but it made me think. A couple weeks ago, I listened to a story on NPR. It's actually they replayed it. It was something they'd done a while ago. About it was a little bit about catcalling, about men call women. And it was on This American Life, and it was a show about people who are trying to change someone else's mind about something. That was the thing. And one of the snippets was this Australian, young Australian woman who was a journalist who decided to look into this idea of like catcalling or whatever. And she was in some, I can't remember what city she was in, but some popular area. There's a lot of clubs and bars and stuff like that. And she was like going around and. She went out one night, and any man who, like, catcalled her, she was like, can I talk to you for a minute? and trying to have conversations with men about why they were doing that. And there's this, the guy that she focused on in the story was a bouncer at a club, and she ended up going back a couple days later, like, middle of the week, like, and was just like, hey, can I have a conversation with you about this? And she ended up having several conversations with him. Fascinating. But one bit that is he was like, oh, I'm not trying to make, I don't want to make anybody, like, he was sort of horrified at the idea that anybody would feel bad. He's like, I'm just trying to add to the fun and add to the atmosphere. And one of the things that he did is when a group of women would walk by, he would, like, pick the prettiest one or whatever and, like, smack her on the butt. And he was like, but he had all these ways. He was like, well, I would never do that to a woman who was by herself. I only do it when there's a group. And she's like, well, what's fun about that? And he's like, yeah, it's just they laugh and they whatever. And she said, how do you think the women feel about it? He's like, oh, they think it's fun. They think it's funny. They laugh and whatever. And so then she went out another Saturday night and just interviewed women who were out about, like, how do you respond and how do you feel? And every single woman said, like, she's like, what do you do when men catcall you whatever? And every single woman said, oh, I just smile or laugh or brush it off because I'm afraid if I don't, it will escalate. Mm-hmm. That's the way I can get out of it. I'm afraid if I push back or if I stay stopped, that it could escalate and it could become violent, it could become worse, and I can become targeted.
Every single woman said that. And I think that, you know, this is a different thing than pornography, but I'm just listening. I'm like, if men are like, oh, well, I do this, and women laugh, and it's, so they're okay with it. And but if that's also what you're seeing. Like, yeah. You know, I can sit here and be like, how can you be so stupid? But I, but yeah, this guy yeah. really, he seemed to, like,
really
genuinely
think. Yeah.
It was, you know, and so it's like, I mean, just in the same way, anything we watch on a screen impacts us. It doesn't have to be about pornography or sexuality, like commercials. I mean, anything, you know, we're affected by that. So, it, and you think, like, the number of men who are watching it, the amount that they're watching it, like, I mean, it has to be just a huge
factor. Yeah, and women, too, they're watching it.
Yeah, but I think as far as the Me Too movement.
But it's interesting reading the, again, this is just last week's New York Times Magazine, because it was the first thing that I had read that had so many, it probably has five or six of them, like anecdotes from kids, 13-year-old boys, 17-year-old girls, and just how unsure, like, they were about, well, I think women want this, you know, and, you know, they're in a more vulnerable context, like this porn literacy class where they're able to talk about it this way, but I'm sure when they're with their friends, you know, they're like, oh, machismo, I'm going to do this or do that. But then in the class, they're like, I don't know. I've never actually had sex, you know, like, I don't know. And just how can, you know, yeah, I mean, how people navigate these images they're watching all the time. And they're not, again, they're not watching to learn, but they're learning. And it somehow creates... You know, it sounds like this guy has he's made these sort of rules to make it okay in his mind.
Yeah.
Like, where did those come from? Clearly
and
not from talking to women.
And he stuck hard to those rules. I mean, she kept pushing back against him.
Yeah.
He had ways to justify it.
Yeah. Well, that was a long talk. Does anyone else have anything to say? Or?
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you all for sticking around.